Well, welcome everybody. People are just kind of gathering around now. It's really good to see you all here. I think we could get some more chairs and generally pull them up there. There's a chair there. Do come and sit there. A warm welcome to the third in the series I'm doing here, which is called as a series, The Inklings, Fantasists or Prophets. And those of you who've been able to be here for the other talks will know that I'm very much saying the latter. And if they're fantasists, then their fantasies prove to be a form of prophecy. I spoke in the other talks about the fact that literary history and social history, as far as it's paid any attention to the Inklings at all, has tended to try and pigeonhole them as a little group of slightly reactionary sort of tweed-covered Oxford dons who didn't like modernity and amused themselves by telling fairy stories, you know, smoking pipes and drinking frothy beer and projecting their fantasies onto some sort of idealised medieval past. And by caricaturing them in that way, it allowed people who thought of themselves as the mainstream of intellectual life in England, it allowed them conveniently to ignore them. And the case I've been making and will continue to make throughout these talks is that very far from being a kind of an evasive or escapist or fantasist little sect of people that didn't want to engage with modern reality, this was a group of thinkers who engaged profoundly with modern reality, at the most visceral way you possibly can, which is, by being young officers on the Western Front and seeing the full-scale industrialization and mechanization of death in modern warfare, that they had read their Nietzsche and they had read their Freud, they'd read their Marx, they understood all the various reductive, atomizing, mechanistic, behaviorist accounts of what it is to be human that were flourishing at the beginning of the 20th century. They had weighed these in the balance and found them wanting, and the thing they had most found wanting in all those approaches to a knowledge of what is, the thing they had found almost completely lacking, was the use of imagination as a way of apprehending truth. And I hinted to you last time in my talk about Lewis that in terms of this restoration of the imagination as a faculty of meaning and knowledge, the key player, not only for Lewis, but actually for Tolkien as well, the key player is the first Inkling and the last Inkling. He's been called the least known of the Inklings, but perhaps in terms of prophecy and looking forward to where we are now, the most prophetic and profound of the Inklings, and that's Owen Barfield. And I want to talk to you very briefly. I can only give you a hint, a few samplings and savours of the range of Barfield's work and of what I think is its importance. And that's what I'm going to try and do for you in the next hour. Now, I want, before I do that, to make an introduction, which is I'm really pleased that we've actually got Owen Barfield's grandson here, also Owen Barfield. I'll never forget, and I've been doing some work on Barfield with my colleague Fraser Watts and been thinking a lot about him. And I came up to Girton one day and there was a note in the porter's lodge that said, Owen Barfield phoned you, could you please call him back? And I'm thinking, he died in 1997, I can't cope. And then I found I had an email from him. But actually, not only was I pleased, but simply because of that natural human connection, and Owen has in fact come up and spoken to us at Girton. But much more importantly, Owen is now involved in a really, I think, vital project to republish his grandfather's works, and particularly to bring out new ones, ones that we've never seen, ones that were in manuscript, and particularly some works of, as it were, myth and poetry and fiction and imagination that I think are going to be really, really important in the coming decades. So it's just great to have you here.
And Thank you.
We'll talk a little bit about that publishing project a little bit later in my talk when I but I enjoyed the talk you gave us at Girton, lots of you will know of course that those of you that delight in Lewis and in the Narnia books that the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is dedicated to Lucy Barfield, and we often felt there's perhaps some links between that Lucy and Lucy Pevensey, and Lucy's your aunt, isn't it?
You are.
Well, so,
passed away.
So that's very nice. I think we've got Lucy's nephew. Anyway, so we're going to bring that back in, but I think I hope everything I've got to say is not going to be about, oh gosh, I wish I'd been around back then. Wouldn't it have been nice to have gone into through the doors of the Bird and Baby and taken part in those conversations? Of course, it would have been nice. But I think it's much more vital to say those conversations are not over. They're still happening and they need developing. And one of the things I also want to say, I hope if time allows, is to suggest to you some of the ways in which that conversation, particularly the conversation with Barfield, continues now, and some of the writers and philosophers and scientists that are beginning to pick up on his wisdom. He himself said in an interview towards the end of his life that he didn't actually expect people to get him or to quite grasp what he was on about until, say, 50 years after his death. So I'm getting in there early, sort of to start the trend. So just very briefly, a little bit of biography just to sort of fill you in and a little bit of fitting him in with Lewis before we go on to look at the core of what he himself had to say and why it's relevant to us. So his dates are 1898 to 1997. So a long life and full and rich and active, I think, you know, right to the end. Absolutely sharp as a razor in terms of his analytical thinking, but also this great wide imagination. He's been, I think, rightly called the first and the last of the Inklings. The first in the sense that he met Lewis in Oxford in 1919. So that's well before Lewis's conversion to anything even like theism. That's actually, in a sense, the angry young Lewis returned from the Western Front, author of a volume of poetry called Spirits in Bondage, which contains, it's the angry atheist. Not only do I not believe in God, but I think he's terrible. And I'm going to point the finger at him. Lewis, I think, was to some degree trying to take revenge on his own intuitive and imaginative feelings because he felt they were leading him into an abyss. There was nothing there to imagine. There was just this grim reality of this awful world that we live in. And he was kind of keeping his imagination at bay. And I think one of the things that Barfield did for Lewis was to stop that, not to let him do that, to bring Lewis back again and again to the importance of poetry and myth as truth bearers. And they had an extraordinary, as it were, correspondence, you might even want to say, quarrel with each other. Now, quarrel, we must qualify. I began my whole talk about the Inklings by quoting extensively from Lewis's essay, The Four Loves, in particular the essay on philia and friendship. And in there he distinguishes between the first friend, who's the person that you are just totally kin with and you love the same things for the same reasons and find the same things in them. For Lewis, that was a guy called Arthur Greaves. But the second friend, said Lewis, is equally important. He's read all the same things but got the wrong thing out of them. He sees the same thing but comes at it from another angle. And he challenges you at every point. But you love him because he cares as passionately as you do about the truth and about the truth in those very points on which he's challenging you. Now, that conversation with the second friend took the form of an extraordinary correspondence about which a very good book has recently been written, a book by a guy called Lionel Adie. Lewis and Barfield referred to this conversation as the Great War, which again was a wonderful piece of English self-deprecation. You know, they'd been through, well, Lewis had certainly been through this horror, which you could hardly look at, which everybody historically called the Great War. But he was saying, actually, there's another war, and it's a war of ideas. And it was in that Great War that Barfield essentially won an argument with Lewis, which was an argument about the validity of imagination as a truth-bearing faculty. And that had huge consequences, not only for Lewis, but also for Tolkien. So there's a little bit of the background. Now, Barfield has been much less known and much less in the public eye than either Lewis or Tolkien. Though actually the people who've really read and grasped his books, and some of them quite widely known people, have said extraordinary things. The Howard Nemiroff, for example, the US poet laureate, said, among the poets and teachers of my acquaintance who know poetic diction, the book of Barfield's I referred to last time, Among those who know poetic diction, it has been valued not only as a secret book, but nearly as a sacred book. And Saul Bellow, Nobel Prize-winning novelist, wrote about Barfield, "We are well supplied with interesting writers, but Owen Barfield is not content to be merely interesting. His ambition is to set us free. Free from what? From the prison we have made for ourselves by our ways of knowing, our limited and false habits of thought, our common sense." So, I hope to liberate you from your common sense. Now, there are so many ways one might take in to Barfield, but I actually want to start with a book which comes quite late, because it was published, I think, in the 70s. It's a collection of essays all gathered together in one volume called The Rediscovery of Meaning. And Poetic Diction was the first Barfield book I read, and that had and still has a profound influence on the way I think. But this was, for me, the second great discovery, because he analysed what seemed to me to be the crisis of modernity as I felt it. And I want to start with the opening paragraph of this book, The Rediscovery of Meaning, and also with a little bit from a review he wrote of a book about reductive science called Where the Wastelands Ends by Theodore Rusek. And I just hope that this will ring bells for you. This is the opening words of the introduction to The Rediscovery of Meaning, written, I think, probably in the late 60s or early 70s. "Amid all the menacing signs that surround us in the middle of this 20th century, perhaps the one which fills thoughtful people with the greatest foreboding is the growing general sense of meaninglessness. It is this which underlies most of the other threats. How is it that the more able man becomes to manipulate the world to his advantage, the less he can perceive any meaning in it? This is the paradox which has often been noted and has sometimes been attributed to fundamental perversity, a sort of pure cussedness in human nature. In fact, however, it arises from a clearly identifiable and comparatively recent bit of history." And he goes on to talk about the demythologization of nature, the reduction of everything to just particles, dead and inert. And just to give you an idea of that kind of analysis, this is another short passage from another essay in this book, which is absolutely prophetic, I think. It's called The Coming Trauma of Materialism. And he basically says this view of the world as entirely valueless stuff is not going to survive, and it's not going to survive because it's false and because it's deeply injurious to everything that is of deepest value in the human spirit. We can kid ourselves, but we can only kid ourselves for so long. And he says there will be a massive crisis philosophically. Actually, he also thought financially, economically, and in every other way, because we can't sustain this false way of living. But here's what he writes in this essay, The Coming Trauma of Materialism. As a piece of sheer analysis of the way science has developed and the way human knowledge has gone, this is kind of pre-Dawkins, it's pretty impressive. "The vaunted progress of knowledge, which has been going on since the 17th century, has been progress in alienation. The alienation first of nature from humanity, which the exclusive pursuit of objectivity in science entails, was the first stage. And it was followed with the acceptance of man himself as a part of nature so alienated by the alienation of man from himself. This final and fatal step in reductionism occurred in two stages. First, his body, and then his mind. Newton's approach to nature was already, by contrast with older scientific traditions, a form of behaviorism. And what has since followed has been its extension from astronomy and physics into physiology and ultimately psychology." Do you follow that? That he's saying, we decided to stop thinking about the cosmos and nature itself as living, moving, breathing meaning. And we decided to think of it as a mechanism and then to analyze it in mechanistic terms. And then we said, hey, the body's part of that as well, so let's do that with the body. And then they said, well, you know, the mind is, you know, probably just produced by something mechanical in the brain. Let's do that with the brain. And in the end, we don't know, as we kind of cut the knife to dissect ourselves into these little atomistic bits, we don't even know anymore what it is that's holding the knife. What is the mind that's doing the analysis? Because we've reduced everything to these little bits. We've started actually at the wrong end. We've started with what we think of as objectively existing tiny particles and thought out of that we can derive something as rich as mind and meaning. We might have been better to have started with the prime experience that we have of mind and meaning and then figure out where the little bits come in. So there's an analysis, pretty acute, of what the problem is. For the rest of what I want to say this evening, I want to talk about Barfield's reaction to that and how through his love of language and his life as a philologist, as somebody who studied the growth and history of language, he began first to intuit and then profoundly to study and argue for an answer to that problem of alienation and an alternative view. So in a late interview with Barfield for a film which I really recommend you find, I think it's available on the web now, it's called Owen Barfield, Man and Meaning. He was asked about how he first became deeply interested in poetry, and poetry is a way of knowledge, and how he came to write his two early classic works, History in English Words, 1926, and Poetic Diction, 1928. Barfield says, I began to find that I had very sharp experiences in reading poetry. Not so much of whole poems, certainly, not long poems, but particular phrases, particular lines seem to have some kind of, one uses the word, magic. I can't think of any other, but poetry was beginning to mean a lot to me, but more from the point of view of particular moments than a considered critical appreciation of a poem as a whole work of art. Especially metaphor seemed to do it, particularly metaphor. Metaphor seemed to say things to me that nothing else did, and it seemed to be something which was untouchable by the overriding materialism of my outlook. Something untouchable by the over. So he himself, like Lewis, his friend, at that stage, had an overridingly materialistic outlook. But he was having these sharp tugs, these extraordinary experiences in reading poetry that simply said, there is something more. There is something here in this experience of meaning in poetry which cannot be reduced the way I'm supposed to be reducing everything else. Maybe that's a clue I should follow up. And essentially, that is what he did. And he wrote these two early books, one, as I say, History in English Words, and the other, Poetic Diction. I want to major on Poetic Diction, but I just want to read you one very short passage from the opening chapter of History in English Words, because it captures an insight which proved to be crucial for the rest of Barfield's work. And I did try and summarize this a little bit last time in the Lewis talk. Do you remember I talked to you about how the archaeologist digs down through the layers of the accumulated soil into the sort of previous layers of a civilization and finds broken shards and bits which can be perhaps pieced together to give us a picture, in our minds at least, of what the outward and visible life of those people was. But what Barfield, when he really began to study language itself, felt was that language itself and the survival into use now of words which are themselves thousands and thousands of years old and whose earlier meanings can be traced back also gives us a kind of archaeology, if you like, of the mind. This is the way he puts it. It has only just begun to dawn on us that in our own language alone, not to speak of its many companions, the past history of humanity is spread out in an imperishable map. Just as the history of the mineral earth lies embedded in layers of its outer crust. But there is this difference between the record of the rocks and the secrets which are hidden in language. Whereas the former can only give us knowledge of outward dead things, such as forgotten seas and the bodily shapes of prehistoric animals, language has preserved for us the inner living history of man's soul. It reveals The Evolution of Consciousness. Now, he wrote that in 1926. And in a sense, everything he wrote since is a development of that. The realization that the way we have consciousness now is not the way we've always had it. And it doesn't have to be the way we always will have it. And we can learn from a previously participative and involved and meaning-drenched way of understanding, and we can move again towards such a thing. And that the little bit of history we happen to be living in, where everything out there is dead and dry as dust, is only a little bit of history. And we carry around with us in our minds the memory of another way of seeing, which is embedded into poetry and into the metaphor of poetry. That's the kind of core idea. Now, it's difficult because Barfield's arguments are very beautifully done and very fine and often extend over many pages. It's very difficult to kind of summarise things. This idea that by finding out what words used to mean, you can get a different view of, as it were, consciousness itself, is actually, he explains it rather well in a shorter passage in a later book called Speaker's Meaning, which I see a new edition, you've got a new edition out of this, which is fabulous. So I want to read you a little bit of Speaker's Meaning, in which, just to get you this idea, the idea itself is also at large in poetic diction, but it's not so pithily put as it is here. And then I'm going to read you a couple of golden passages from poetic diction in which he talks about what it's like to experience a felt change of consciousness in poetry. But this is a very interesting passage. He says, words, he's made a distinction between inner and outer. That a thing can have an outer meaning, just what we think of as physically what it is, and then it can have an inner meaning, which we now think of as a kind of metaphorical meaning. But he's interested in why we have to choose between outer and inner, why we can't have both at once. So this is what he writes. Words, which for us today have an outer meaning only, formerly had an inner meaning as well. Moreover, the process by which they have lost their inner meaning is clearly the obverse or correlative of the very process by which many other words have lost their outer meaning. Both processes may be well illustrated by the histories of such terms as breath, or air, or wind, and spirit. For here they happen to be sharply pointed by a well-known record from a period when they were not as yet completed. In the English version of St. John's Gospel, chapter 3, we find the following three verses in which both terms, air or wind, breath or spirit, in which both terms are employed alternately. So, John 3, verse 6. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the spirit is spirit. Marvel not that I said unto thee, ye must be born again. The wind bloweth where it listeth, and thou hearest the sound thereof, but canst not tell whence it cometh and whither it goeth. So is everyone that is born of the spirit. End of quotation. Back to Barfield. Probably most people read the first part of verse 8, that's the verse beginning, the wind bloweth where it listeth. Probably most people read the first part of verse 8 as a metaphor comparing the spirit with the wind. But if we turn to the Greek, we find it is not so. The same word, pneuma, is employed throughout, though it has been rightly translated first as spirit and then as wind and then again as spirit. In Hellenistic Greek, pneuma still conveyed the concomitant meanings, but the English translators had to split it into two words, one of which, spirit, has since lost its outer meaning, so it only means that inner invisible spirit that is your conscious soul, while the other, wind, has lost its inner meaning. For us, the wind only means that things we blow. It doesn't mean anything spiritual at all. We've split these two things up that were once apprehended together as a unity. So he notices, by seeing how a word was used, that there was once a different way of configuring the world altogether. Do you see that? And he sees that we've split and separated things which might be together. Now, in the course of poetic diction, he was trying to grasp what exactly happens when we experience poetry as poetry. Not when we're counting the meter and saying, oh, it rhymes, it must be a poem, but when suddenly we have a sort of aha moment, we have a kind of thrill, we have some sense of the poetry has happened. I mean, you might think that's the single most difficult thing to put your finger on. What is that, and when does it happen, and why? But that's what he tries to do in this book. And he refers to that experience of poetry as a change of consciousness. And he was discussing this with C.S. Lewis as he was working on this. And C.S. Lewis said, isn't just a change of consciousness, it's a felt change of consciousness. And Lewis added that word. So fairly early on in poetic diction, he says that. I find myself obliged to define it as a felt change of consciousness, where consciousness embraces all my awareness of my surroundings at any given moment, and surroundings includes my own feelings. By felt, I mean to signify that the change itself is noticed or attended to. So something happens that's not just I'm reading a poem and I've got a bit of the meaning of the poem. It's much more like, suddenly my whole world looks different. I feel and see things in a different way. Some changes happen. He elaborates that a little bit later in a very extraordinary passage, I think, a very beautiful passage, where he uses an analogy drawn from science, actually, of what happens when you pass a wire near a magnet. And if it's moving, as it moves across the magnet, a current. About the generation of electricity is very interesting. Let me read you this. This is a little later. It's in a chapter called The Effects of Poetry. He's saying, when does this felt change of consciousness happen? The phrase must be taken with some exactness. Appreciation takes place at the actual moment of change. It's not simply that the poet enables me to see with his eyes and so to apprehend a larger and fuller world. He may indeed do this, as we shall see later. But the actual moment of the pleasure of appreciation depends upon something rarer and more transitory. It depends on the change itself. If I pass a coil of wire between the poles of a magnet, I generate in it an electric current. But I only do so while the coil is positively moving across the lines of force. Current only flows where I'm actually bringing the coil in or taking it away again. So it is with the poetic mood, which, like the dreams to which it has often been compared, is kindled by the passage from one plane of consciousness to another. It lives during that moment of transition and then dies. And if it is to be repeated, some means must be found of renewing the transition itself. And he goes on. Poetry as a possession, as our own souls enriched, is another matter. When it has entered so deeply into our being that we no longer concern ourselves with its diction. At this saved stage, the diction has served its end and may be forgotten. For if ever we go back to linger lovingly over the exquisite phrases of some fragrant passage of poetry whose essence has long been our own and of which the spirit has become part of our every waking moment, we do this, is it not for the very reason that we want to renew the thrill which accompanied that first acquisition of the treasure? Our lips murmur the well-known, or it may be the long-forgotten words. We're trying, whether deliberately or not, to cast ourselves back into the frame of mind which was ours when we had first learnt this lesson. Why? Because we know instinctively that if we are to feel pleasure, we must have change. Everlasting day can no more freshen the earth with dew than everlasting night. But the change from night to day and from day back again to night is what moves us. It's an interesting idea, we come back. So we feel this change. Now he then goes and says, why? What's changing? If we're moving from one plane of consciousness to another as we read a great piece of poetry, which is the plane we've lost? Which is the plane we're gaining? And this leads him back to that point I'd made earlier about old words and their embedded, their giving us a different view of the world and the way people saw wind and spirit as one thing. He felt that poetry embodied or kept going a treasury of this older way of seeing prior to the split, which has led to our alienation. And it's almost as though for a minute we're given a glimpse of another way of seeing the world, which it would be perilous for us to forget. And that's why the poetry itself is so important and gives us an angle on truth. Now, he believed this not only of poetry, but of the great myths. He felt all the great myths embodied powerful truths about the nature of the world to which we no longer have access in our rational way of thinking. But if we can enter into those myths and get into the story again, then something that was lost is communicated to us. And to try and explain what it is we've lost and what it is we've gained in the more scientific view of the world that we have now, he avails himself of a myth. He actually uses the story of Odin. And you may remember that Odin, in order to acquire knowledge, has to make a sacrifice. Odin is on Yggdrasil, the world tree, which connects the nine worlds of the Norse mythological imagination, and whose branches are up in Asgard and whose roots are in hell. And the world tree, the tree which is a kind of tree of knowledge, has written with its roots onto the stones at its base letters, which are the runes. And Odin wants to acquire this knowledge, this analytical knowledge, if you like, of the world. And you remember when he goes down to the bottom of that tree, he has to bargain for it, and he has to pluck out one of his own eyes in order to acquire that knowledge. And that's why he's often depicted as this one-eyed character. So Barfield says, our sophistication, like Odin's, has cost us an eye. And now it is the language of poets, insofar as they create true metaphors, which must restore this lost unity conceptually, after it has first been lost from perception. Thus, the before unapprehended relationships of which Shelley spoke, he's been talking about Shelley's defense of poetry, for though they were never yet apprehended, they were at one time seen. So he's saying poets had a different, people had a different vision of the world. Poets have preserved it. And he says, through the imagination of the poet, we can see again with two eyes. Okay, does that, am I making sense for you there? I'm going to skip on and just read you the concluding words of Poetic Diction to give you a little bit more of a flavour of what it is that he's saying and why he's suggesting that we need poetry. He says, without the continued existence of poetry, without a steady influx of new meaning into language, even the knowledge and wisdom which poetry herself has given in the past must wither away into a species of mechanical calculation. That's a great phrase, wither away into a species of mechanical calculation. Great poetry is the progressive incarnation of life into consciousness. In other words, it's tapping into a wisdom which is in the source of life and consciousness itself and embodying it in language. And because language changes the way you perceive and have consciousness, it's communicated. Is that making sense? So great poetry is the progressive incarnation of life in consciousness. Hence the absolute value of aesthetic pleasure as a criterion. Before we can feel it, we must have become aware in some degree of the actual progress, not merely its results, over the perpetual evolution of human consciousness, which is stamping itself upon the transformation of language. Over that evolution, the spirit of poetry hovers, forever unable to alight. It is only when we are lifted above that transformation, so that we behold it as a present movement, that our startled souls feel the little pat and throbbing feathery warmth which tell us that she has perched. That's poetry, the muse. It is only when we have risen from beholding the creature into beholding creation that our mortality catches for a moment the music of the turning spheres. Amazing way to end a book. You can imagine the impact that that had. I mean, it had an extraordinary impact on Lewis and made him realise that a completely reductive way of viewing the world was not going to be the way out of the wounds of his own soul. Now, do you remember the passage I read you in the Lewis talk last time about the two hemispheres of his mind and how divided they were? And he said, who can reconcile them? Who can bring these two together? And he had this strong sense that the answer to that was Christ, that in Christ, in the incarnation, where if you like, everything that is, you think of as the word, the logos, the true meaning and deepest, you know, pre-existent beauty of everything, which is, if you like, non-physical, and which he'd been taught of to think as the merely subjective, becomes absolutely physical. The word is made flesh and dwells among us. And the two halves come together because there you have both inner and outer. Yeah? And you remember how it was a conversation with Tolkien in Addison's Walk and afterwards, which helped him to bring the idea of everything that was meaningful in myth and everything that was meaningful in the objective science of what's here together in one thing, myth made history, word made flesh. A healing union and reconciling of these different opposites. Remember, we had that for Lewis. Now, the very fact that Lewis already responded so deeply to myth and thought myth was full of conveying real truth was due to Barfield. It was Barfield who'd shown that as you entered into myth and poetry, this transition between planes of consciousness happened, and the leap of the heart, the feathery touch, was a confirmation of some kind of truth. And now, for Lewis, of course, that became fact. Now, curiously enough, at a different stage and in a different way, the same thing also happened for Barfield. Barfield, and this is the subject, really, of his major book, which we're not going to have. It's such a world in itself, we can scarcely go into it. His great book, Saving the Appearances, where he tries to think about the evolution of consciousness. Where's it come from? Where's it going to? It turned out that the argument for Barfield about that ultimately turned centrally on the nature and person of Jesus Christ as well. It's very difficult to summarise this. I'm going to do my best. Barfield thought that the linguistic evidence, as he read it, was that there must have been a time when our mode of consciousness was, as it were, so completely at one with the whole cosmos, with outer and inner together, that we could talk about wind and breath and spirit as one thing, and that our actual experience of breathing was also the experience of the God blowing the wind into us, was also breathing out, was of being one with the winds that blew, was kind of one breath. In fact, it's curious, when you look at a lot of Native American accounts of reality, it's incredibly close to what Barfield himself is trying to say. Now, he realises that we've come away from that. Now, it might have been a really, you know, you could imagine a sort of romantic nostalgia in which you would say, oh, that's how we lost paradise. Indeed, in some ways, he thinks the myth of paradise lost, or the mythos. Remember, whenever I use the word myth in any of these talks, I mean really, really true. And not using the word, that there is some kind of utterly unified paradise out of which we've fallen. Now, instead of nostalgically saying, well, great, I'll just keep reading poetry and try to get back to it, in Saving the Appearances, Barfield says, well, maybe there's a purpose in our having lost that. Maybe there's something else important needs to happen. And what he felt the other important thing was happening is that if there's not really a distinction between my breath and the wind that blows and the one spirit that blows through the world, then I don't really exist as a separate thinking being. In order for me to be me, for me to be a person with their own distinct personhood, individuated, and as a Christian would want to say, a person of infinite value, simply in themselves as a person, I have to be, as it were, individuated out from the rest, distinct from it. But that very moment of being distinct involves me saying there's a subjective me inside and an objective it out there, yeah? And as soon as I start doing that, a process begins in which I become alienated from that. And you see that? And that process, he felt, was going on, and then it got really accelerated in our own time. So first of all, we said, okay, there's loads of meaning, but it's all in here. The stuff out there is dead. And then we got to this point, well, actually, maybe the stuff in here is kind of the same as the stuff out there. And if that's meaningless, then this is meaningless. That, you know, the crisis of meaning. Okay? So the alienation has gone so far that you think, it may have given me my individual self, but if my individual self has no ultimate meaning, you know, what's the point of having it? Now, Barfield came to the conclusion that the reason why we've, as it were, lost what he called original participation, that participation, was so that we could become people, so that we could become distinct souls. But that if we went down that path of utter distinction forever, we would land in a kind of hell of total isolated alienation. And that there therefore must be at some point a turning point, a return movement. And that the return movement towards what he, in his book Saving the Appearances, calls final participation, will be a return to a beautifully meaning-drenched universe in which all these things relate to one another personally, but without the loss of personhood. So he's searching around the whole of the history of language and philosophy and religion to see, is there any sign of this? Is there any way in which one could say that a person could be both individuated out as a distinct person, utterly themselves, physically material, aware of the difference between themselves and the rest of the world and themselves and other people and all of that, and distinct from the great one spirit of cosmic being that might have brought all this into being? Is there any example of somebody that could be that, which we all are, but at the same time re-experience, without losing that personhood, re-experience and go back into a participation and a loving oneness with the other? And looking around the history of philosophies and religions, he came to Jesus Christ. And he found it quite extraordinary that Christ is on the one hand clearly an individual kind of person, you know, who had relations with people and could be crucified and die at a certain point, but who spoke of himself constantly as at one with the Father, and yet at the same time as distinct from the Father. That in Christ, we seem to have somebody in whom that process of withdrawing out was full, but also who seemed to have everything that had been lost, and who seemed to be offering that everything that had been lost back to the rest of us as he breathed out his spirit and used that very word. Indeed, this very conversation about being born again, about beginning again in a new mode of consciousness, was the very conversation he had with Nicodemus, and it turned on the very things of this. So Barfield began to see that that's just a really crucial thing. And I want to, I didn't manage to print it off, so I'm kind of, this is amazing. I don't know what Barfield would make of this particular bit of technology, but I had to summon it up from a document on my iPhone. This is from an amazing essay, which is in, it's in The Rediscovery of Meaning, and it's got the slightly difficult title of Religio Philologiae. He wasn't really good at snappy titles, Barfield, actually. The Religion of a Philologist, in which he talked about his own conversion, if you like, to centrality of Christ, and actually makes a comparison with Lewis. He says, it is possible, I know, because it happened in my case, for a man to have been brought up in the belief and to have taken it for granted that the account given in the Gospels of the birth and resurrection of Christ is a noble fairy story with no more claim to historical accuracy than any other myth. Okay, that's how he's brought up. And it is possible for such a man, after studying in depth the history of the literature and tradition that has grown up around it, and to accept, if you like, to be obliged to accept the record of Jesus Christ, as an historical fact, not because of the authority of church, nor by any process of ratiocination such as C.S. Lewis has recorded in his own case, but rather because it fitted so inevitably with the other facts as he had already found them, rather because he felt in the utmost humility that if he had never heard of it through the scriptures, he would have been obliged to try his best to invent something like it as a hypothesis to save the appearances. Okay? So that's in Religio Philologiae, but it's also something that he argues in Saving the Appearances. I should say that the book Saving the Appearances, it's a technical title there. It's to do with the idea that the appearances of things as they are can be accounted for in lots and lots of different ways. And there's a lot more going on out from our minds into how we shape things than we realise. So you can see the resonances with Lewis. Now, nevertheless, in spite of that, he and Lewis remained, as it were, second friends, because whereas Lewis's path to this, after a lot of philosophy, came back to the Gospels themselves, particularly as a way, and Lewis became, you know, a very thoroughly going Orthodox Christian in, you know, in every respect. Barfield's journey into this question of how does consciousness broadly relate to individual consciousness and how does that relate to the stuff out there led him into contact with the thought of Rudolf Steiner, whom he deeply admired and regarded as a real authority, and many of whose thoughts he, Barfield, had already kind of come to as his own conclusion. So Barfield became a follower of Steiner, and Steiner's view of things, which is, as we know from this church, having heard Fraser preach about it, is Steiner's view of things. It's called anthroposophy, and it is essentially Christocentric. It does believe that the coming of Christ is a turning point in the cosmos. But it has a whole load of other stuff, which people like C.S. Lewis, and I would be with Lewis on this one, couldn't accept, such as reincarnation and all kinds of things. So there are real differences. I don't want to gloss over those differences. But I do want to say that what Barfield is on about here is of central importance. And I think you can follow Barfield all the way to his understanding of Christ. I think what he says about poetry and poetic diction, about the necessity of poetry, about the whole need for the whole world to turn beyond this mechanistic view and reintegrate in a chosen participation back into meaning. I think all of that is totally true, vitally important. And you don't have to buy into any of the other, as it were, extra Steinerian stuff that he does in order to follow that, okay? That's my view. You really need to read Saving the Appearances. I can't possibly kind of summarise it as well as it needs to be summarised, but that should at least give you a flavour, and probably the two most important books, if you like, of philosophy and theology are Poetic Diction, Saving the Appearances, and then this great book of essays, the Rediscovery of Meaning. However, Lewis and Tawkey have won the world over, as it were, and, you know, have this huge public, not because they were profound philosophers and philologists, which they were, but because they managed to express the truth of their deepest academic and philosophical and theological and spiritual experiences in the very language of myth and poetry, what Tawkey called mythopoesis. A term he actually got and thought through from Barfield. Barfield had a huge influence on Tolkien, and that's very well written about in a book called Splintered Light. So one might say, what a pity that Owen Barfield couldn't have taken a leaf out of their books and written some mythopoeic fiction that would embody his ideas in a much more lucid and, if you like, imagined form rather than this abstract language. And I remember thinking just exactly that as I was, you know, reading through some of the more rigorously challenging bits of Saving the Appearances. Well, the good news, which is why it's so great to have the other Owen Barfield, the incredibly good news is that he did. It's just it didn't get out there at the time, but the time has come for it. Now, my first encounter with it, and I'm going to read you a little bit of that before I then have a conversation with Owen here. My first encounter with that other Barfield, the Barfield who is himself a poet and a myth maker, is through a fabulous book. I don't know if this is going to be part of the programme of republishing. I hope it is.
It is, yeah.
Oh, thank God. This is the one copy in the UL, and I feel it may be like the one or two copies in England of this play, Orpheus. Now, in the myth of Orpheus, the one who loses, you know, his beloved Persephone, the one who loses her because he turns around to look at her and can't let her be, and the one who is torn to pieces as a result, and then ultimately brought back together again. In the myth of Orpheus, Barfield totally expressed everything I've been trying to tell you in abstract language in an incredible verse play. And just to let you know that for all their differences on other things, Lewis absolutely understood what Barfield was doing and loved it. Let me read you what Lewis said in 1948, before what I believe was the one and only production of this play ever. Though, by the way, you heard it first here. As I've been working on Barfield again for this, I've come to the conclusion that this play needs doing again. If not as a full production, it certainly needs a measured reading out, and I think St. Edward's is the church to do it. So watch this space. But this is what Lewis says. I await with great interest the public reaction to a work which has influenced me so deeply as Barfield's Orpheus. On the technical side, it presents us with a variety almost as rich as that of the Shepherd's Calendar. I hope that this will not be mistaken for virtuosity. The alliterative lines, the trochaic couplets, the blank verse and the lyrics are in reality so responsive to the different states of being they embody that they serve the same purpose as dramatic orchestration. They mediate in drama which the Orpheus, they mediate a drama which the Orpheus in each of us will understand best if he at first leaves the Eurydice in him free to follow the images and the melodic development. Isn't that brilliant? There's an Orpheus in you, there's a Eurydice in you, you've got to follow. It is a mystery, not a problem drama. It executes in us a reunion which we always stand in need of, never more than at present. 1948. Let me read you the final speech in this play to give you an idea in poetic form of what it is that he was all about. And then we're going to hear about the novellas, which is just amazing. So, very end of the play, having looked at the agony and destruction, you remember Orpheus was torn to pieces by the Maenads and the apparent breaking up and splitting up and then the promise of reunion. Persephone says, shall this agony profit at all? Shall man at last be whole? I have to say throughout this, there's a Christ-Orpheus thing going on. It's amazing. So shall this agony profit at all? Shall man at last be whole? And the answer to that comes in a chorus, which I think is Barfield's vision of what a final participation in Christ, all of us risen, would be. Here's the final chorus. He shall ascend Parnassus and awake and find his soul. Proteus shall work unsleeping forever, and forms shall flow as the meaning of words a poet has mastered. It shall be so that Zeus shall abandon to Cronos the antique starry crown, and softly out of Olympus the high gods shall come down, shedding ambrosial fragrance in clouds that forever abide. And the earth shall be covered with blushes and make herself sweet as a bride. And her light shall be liquid as honey, her air taste good like bread in the mouths of them that dwell upon earth. And all shall be fed. Wonderful. So that's a taste. Now, I'm going to turn to Owen and say, you sent me, I think maybe a year or two ago now, this book, Night Operation, and then followed up with Eager Spring. Do you want to just say something about that and how you came to publish it?
Okay, thanks, Malcolm. Thank you very much for your talk. I really enjoyed it. And I'm going to say three things about The Literary Estate and three things about Grandfather, which have come to me quite quickly, short things.
Yeah.
But to answer your question about those two books, that's where I started. It was drawn to my attention that those two books had not been published. I thought I ought to do something about it, and that's how I kind of got myself involved in this process. Mm. The tasks of The Literary Estate is just this, to make the works available. There are 21 identified works, which include works on economics and other things, and I'm currently on around about the number 12. And one of those books is a long novella called English People. So that's coming out too, and that's one of those unpublished manuscripts, which fits into that group there. So that's a sort of slow task. We started in 2008, but it will be completed. The other task is grandfather's collection of papers, which had been deposited in the Bodleian Library but wasn't available. We've now catalogued that, so there's an online catalogue. Anyone can reference it. And in those papers, we've found a lot of additional unpublished manuscripts, such as plays and radio speeches and things like that, which is extra material to work on. And the third thing that I really want to do is encourage scholarship. That's why I come over here and support Malcolm and everything that he's doing. There's one PhD student from America working on a PhD on Barfield. And I would ask you to take back to any young people or postgraduates or people who are looking to study this, you know, just encourage them to move in this direction, because the material is now available. There's a lot of work to be done. And frankly, it's an open field. And I'm supportive of any young people who want to study that. That's what I'll say about the literary estate. I really just want to say three things about grandfather, which came to me as I was listening to Malcolm, and in a sense, reinforce what Malcolm has said. The first thing is that, yes, grandfather lived a long life, 99 years, and it was a sort of significant life. He himself wasn't interested in his own biography, but I'll just very quickly say you could think of that life in three equal parts, almost 33 years each, actually, when you work them out. First part is a poet. And that's when he was developing his philosophy, finding his place in the world, and really sort of preparing himself from a poetical author's position. He was then a lawyer for the middle part of his life, and that's when he kind of immersed himself in the reality of life. He was working in the City of London. It was a bleak time for him. The Second World War was going on. It was a terrible time, but he really shared, you know, that human contact. And it was also during that time that he was a lawyer to C.S. Lewis, and he then became C.S. Lewis's executor after Lewis had died. And then the last third of his life, for 33 years, he was a teacher. He was a visiting professor in America, and he spent a lot of time over there lecturing, which is why he's much better known in America than he is in this country. But that was his time to give back, and really most of his books came out then. Mm. But he was an author all through his life, and his very first published book was Silver Trumpet, which was a children's book, which got written and then read to Tolkien's children, and that was really what inspired Tolkien to start forming his works in either way. So Silver Trumpet is his very first book written for children. That kind of gives you an idea of where he's coming from. I'm going to repeat the quote that I think you heard me say previously, and it was in 1986 when I was with grandfather. Grandfather explained to me that it will be 50 years before his work is understood. So it kind of gives us a timescale. It's really important to understand that grandfather was working for the future, if you like. In a way, he was aware that he didn't have a contemporary audience. He was writing for the future. He didn't explain that to me at the time. He's sort of left it to us to rediscover and work out for ourselves. But that's very much grandfather's style. Yeah. He's asking you to work it out for yourself. Think it through. And then the third thing which came to me is, as I've been working on these 11 books, which are the ones that I've currently published, I'm struck by how often grandfather refers to C.S. Lewis. I mean, grandfather knew C.S. Lewis very well, obviously, as a friend, but he didn't have to refer to him. And you even just read out one passage where, again, he refers to Lewis in that passage. And I was just thinking to myself, why did grandfather do that? And that's really the question that I'd like to give to you, and I'm sure that you'll have answers to that. But if I was to put my own answer to that, it's because I think grandfather was aware of who C.S. Lewis was at that moment, in that moment in time, and knew what his role was. And he's sort of saying to people, look, if you can get yourself to where C.S. Lewis was in 1950 or so, you'll understand what I have to say to you now. But if you can't understand what Lewis was saying to you in 1950, you probably won't get me. Yeah. So try and get yourself there, and I'm the route forward.
Thank you. That's brilliant. Let me just, talking about, I want to pick up what you said, that really he was saying what I've written is for the future. That's absolutely key to everything that I've been trying to say in this Inklings talk. I think that was true for all of the Inklings, but I think Owen Barfield was the one who really knew that. And I want to just very briefly, because we've run over our time, flag up to you what's in these books, because this will make it absolutely clear. Night Operation is a science fiction novella set in a dystopic future in which an over-urbanized and mechanistic society has become not only alienated, but absolutely paranoid and constantly afraid of terrorist attack, but also afraid of airborne infection, afraid of anything that hasn't been sort of passed through a grid of health and safety and turned into something completely sanitized. And they decide that the most sanitary place to live is underground in totally controlled conditions where everything is air conditioned. So they're all living up beneath the earth, and they've decided to that if anybody hears a rumour that there was a world up there, that there was a night sky and stars and beauty and fields, and that this is to be regarded as mere mythology. It's just all that myth stuff is not fact. You know, we dwell in the world of fact. Yeah, it's exactly the silver chair. And in fact, the common source for silver chair and this book is Plato's Myth of the Cave. So this is a story about three friends who are very clearly identifiable. I think certainly two of them as Barfield and Lewis. And they get to love the old books in the library of the underground cave that talks about this other world. And they begin to wonder whether it might be really there. And it's a story about how they get up there and how their mind is completely blown by this different level of reality. And the only way they can talk about it at all is to use poetry. And they're tempted to stay up there because it's so much better than this dark, gaseous, mechanistic, closed, blinded world that they've come from. But they don't. They go back, and they go back with a message, and the message is liberation. And that's what this, I mean, I think that really sets out what the Inklings could do for us. They can get us out of the trap. But then, in the 70s, this is even more amazing. This is about a medieval historian, a woman medieval historian, who becomes an eco-warrior. And it's specifically about how our poisonous view of the world, if you like, our Meccans, actually is leading us to literally poison the world. And it's about the development of so-called biocides, as they're called in the book, which is, you know, pesticides on the earth. It's a kind of organic farming book. And it's about, you know, how when they're banned here, people just export them to the third world, and this girl discovers that that's what they're doing. So the outer story is about her attempt to, just in a small way in her own area, cleanse the earth. But then that turns out to be a much deeper kind of psychic cleansing, and in the end, she gets poisoned by the very things that she's trying to prevent everybody else from being poisoned by. And in the kind of fever and trauma, she has a sort of series of visions, which she wrote turns into a fairy story. And the story itself is embedded at the end. And this is an incredible, I just think this is stunning. This is a parable for our times, if ever there was one. I mean, you know, this kind of ought to be issued free with every membership of Greenpeace or Friends of the Earth, you know. It is just incredible. And, you know, if these things had come out then, you know. So I just would want to enthuse wildly about both of those books. I think they're amazing. And you know, we are going to have to draw stumps because I've already kind of gone the time. I'm happy to stop for a little bit and answer any questions, and maybe the two of us could do that, but I do know that people have to go. So if you need to go, feel free to do that, and thank you. I hope I've kind of kindled a bit of enthusiasm for somebody that I think is has really been undervalued and, you know, is more accessible than you think. So anyway, thank you very much for coming, and thank you very much for coming. So do stay for a bit if you'd like to, but equally if you need to go, let's go.
I've seen that book on Orpheus.
Yeah.
I have an American copy.
It's a kind of been covered by the UL, but it's a... just see if this is...
It's a very long afterword, isn't it?
Yeah. Just while we're... Can I read you an amazing bit from The Rediscovery of Meaning that I meant to read out, because he anticipated some of the technology. You know how image-driven we are now? And, you know, like everybody's got to take immediate photos of everything on their iPhone. And you see everybody walking down the streets of Cambridge, you know, like looking through the camera, but they're not actually looking at King's Chapel. They're only... Yeah. In this essay, I mean, it was published in the 70s. It's a brilliant essay called The Harp and the Camera. He writes this. So this must have been... This is before the development of digital photography. He writes, "We live in a camera civilization. Our entertainment is a camera entertainment. Our holidays are camera holidays. We make them so by paying more attention to the camera we brought with us than to the waterfall we are pointing it at. Our science is almost entirely a camera science, and it is already becoming self-evident to camera man that only camera words have meaning. If we pay attention only to surfaces, we won't let words go to their depth. And again, what we get when we read poetry that was written in a harp age, not a camera age, is we get that felt change of consciousness. And as I said last time, that when I talk about poetry of another age, that includes especially the whole of Scripture. The more you soak yourself in the language of Scripture, the more you have access to another mode of consciousness. And one of the things that I think where we don't do Scripture a favour is we sit here with our tight little mechanistic arguments about, you know, how did this piece of outer science happen? And we take the Scripture and we try and reduce it to our existing level of consciousness and then use it as a stick to hit each other with, instead of really letting the pneuma. You know, this is what St. Paul says, the letter killeth, but the spirit giveth life. If we can really know how God breathed, that is, and let the same God that is God breathing the Scripture breathe in us as we read it, we have a whole new approach. Anyway, sorry. Anyway, let's let any comeback from anybody on any of this. Fire away.